Welcome to the Exhale Podcast, a candid conversation about current matters relating to respiratory diagnostic and lung health. Today's hosts are Mark Russell, Marketing and Communications Manager, and Troy Brugin, Executive Vice President of Sales and Operations for Vitalograph in North America, a global leader in respiratory diagnostics. We believe in the power of the patient voice to provide inspiration and hope to others in similar situations. That's why we're thrilled to sit down with John Linnell, an individual who lives with COPD and who, since his diagnosis, has been an advocate for COPD awareness, resources, and research.
Well, John A., welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
John, why don't you please give us a little background on yourself, education experience, and your current responsibilities?
Well, sure. I'm 66 years old. I'm stage 4 COPD patient. I was diagnosed with COPD in late 2005, and due to the progression of the disease, I had to leave the workforce in late 2011. And that was really the beginning of my journey with COPD and becoming involved in both advocacy and being a patient researcher. When I had to stop work, I didn't really know what to do, and no one has yet written the book COPD 101 for Dummies, so I had to figure everything out for myself. And using oxygen, I decided I did not want to be that old man at home with a hose in his nose, so I decided to own my COPD and own my condition. You'll notice I refer to it as a condition, not a disease, because I feel the mindset and a positive mental attitude is so very important. If I tell myself I have a disease, I'm telling myself I'm sick. If I tell myself I have a condition, that's something I can learn to live with and live the best life I can, but I need to own it and I need to know as much about it as I can. And so in my research to find out what's my new normal, who's the new John Linnell, and what does he need to do? I became introduced to the COPD Foundation, and it would take hours to explain everything, but I slowly became more and more involved, being invited to be on a patient panel for a drug company or to help the foundation with a Hill Day and going and speaking to our elected officials about the bills that we need passed. And just one thing led to another, and I'm currently now on 3 or 4 board of directors of national nonprofits for COPD related concerns. I consult with numerous pharmaceutical companies because they're realizing more and more the value and the benefit and the need to have patients more and more involved. The first conference I went to, a drug conference, was all about patient centricity. But it was just a buzzword being bandied about and no one really did anything. And over the years, I'm seeing now, depending on the corporate culture, the pharmaceutical companies are truly embracing patient centricity and really involving the patient. And we can get more into that later, but that's the nuts and bolts of it.
Well, John, thanks for sharing that. That's, I think, a pretty profound perspective. And I love your attitude where you're kind of, like you said, owning it, taking control of it, doing what you can to push back and to live your best life. And I think attitude is so important anytime somebody's dealing with, you know, something of this nature. Can you tell us how someone with COPD can get involved in COPD research? We do clinical trials as part of our business as well. But how would someone with COPD become involved in research?
In actual research or in being a participant in a trial?
I would say with being a participant in a trial.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. It's kind of confusing and complicated because some CROs advertise on Facebook, others on radio. It's not really easy for a patient that, for example, that wants to be in a trial where they would go and find them. Obviously, there is clinicaltrials.gov, which is a really good site, but it is not user-friendly to a patient. We need to understand that the average reading level with a person living with COPD is about the 8th grade reading level. And so you're not dumbing it down, but you need to speak in a language that's understood by the patient, and there needs to be a way where they can more easily find trials. And I think that's a challenge that not only pharma, but industry as a whole needs to tackle. But once you do find them, and actually in one of the nonprofits I work with that I'm on a board for, we have some Facebook groups, and I've had CROs come to me saying, hey, if you help us recruit participants for this trial, we'll make a donation to your nonprofit. And that's a win-win. And so that's another example how patients can be involved to help research at the very beginning by helping to locate and find and recruit the participants. That needs to be done very carefully, though, because of the regulatory rules and that. You can't just say, hey, you want to make some money? Go do this. It's got to be done in a very specific manner that doesn't violate any of the guidelines set forth by both legal and the IRB.
Gotcha. So what are the different types of COPD research or trials that you've been involved with?
As a participant, which was many years ago when I still lived in the Phoenix, Arizona area, it was a new inhaler that was a dual therapy inhaler. So as the different arms that were randomized were placebo drug, placebo placebo, drug placebo, or drug drug, or placebo placebo. And that was about a 3-month trial. And even though it was double blinded, due to my spirometry dropping from 35 to about 18, that told me two things. It told me that I was on placebo, placebo, but it also told me that the inhalers I was using definitely, definitely worked for me. For trials that I've been involved in, either as a member of the Data Safety Monitoring Board or as a co-investigator or just as a patient partner, a lot of them have been more towards, a good example is a PCORI-funded one through Johns Hopkins that I was a co-investigator on. And it was deciding if peer support to help folks that were recently discharged from the hospital from a COPD exacerbation. One arm was given just the normal instructions and directions that a physician would normally give to a patient. And the other half were also recruited into peer support. And they were given a breathing buddy that had been trained, and they would actually get together and meet as a peer support and have learning sessions. And then we studied how that helped, because obviously everyone wants to prevent readmissions and to have their patients have a better quality of life. That showed us that it certainly does, that peer support is incredibly important. The phrase I use is patients tend to listen to other patients, sadly, sometimes more to than their physicians.
John, are you familiar with how early COPD can be detected, and if there are any current research studies on the early stages and the development of COPD?
Well, that's, you've really opened up a can of worms there, because, and actually once I spoke at the American Academy of Family Physicians, and I had 250 physicians in front of me. I was on a panel with some educating doctors, and they had to be there, and if they wanted their points, they had to get the answers right, because it was a CME class. And I started off by saying, I love this. Usually when I go and see you folks, I have to listen to you. Right now, you're a captive audience, and you have to listen to me. And I everyone got a kick out of that. But I told the physicians, I said, when I go to the doctor's office, they weigh me, they see how tall I am, they take my blood pressure, they take my temperature, all of these things, and I'm fine. But what they don't do is they don't do simple spirometry. And if we did simple spirometry, we could capture what I call the missing millions. There are 16 million people in the United States living with COPD. There are another approximately 14 million that have it, but they just don't know it yet because they haven't been diagnosed. When I was diagnosed, it was an annual well check, and I told my doctor, my family doctor, I said, you know, doc, it really sucks getting old. And he looked at me and he queried me, John, you're 49. Well, what do you mean it sucks getting old? That statement bothers me. Let's talk about this. And he knew I had a smoking history. And just based on that one statement, he said, let's get an x-ray. So he got an x-ray. And he said, you know, I can't diagnose you from just an x-ray. I want to send you to a pulmonologist, but I suspect that you have COPD. Lo and behold, within 2 weeks, I had seen a pulmonologist, did simple spirometry, and I was diagnosed with stage 3 COPD. So you're wondering how early can it be detected? It can be detected a lot earlier than when it is detected because it's a progressive disease. And I'm sure I have been living with it for, I don't know, I'm not a physician, so I'm just guessing, 2, 3, maybe 4 years, I was one of the missing millions. And it's really a shame that there are people out there that aren't living the best life they can because they haven't yet been diagnosed. And I think that's a huge medical problem because the cost burden on the American health system is somewhere between, I believe, don't quote me, $50 to $60 billion with a B, dollars a year.
John, you're exactly right. I've said this on the podcast before, that I really feel that when young men like myself and Troy, we go in for our physical, even though we look like we're in good health, we get tested like we're in good health, but nobody does just a general spirometry test just to see where we're at in our stage of our life. And I wholeheartedly agree that early detection is a key in taking care of a person that has early stages of COPD. Is there any current research on COPD health disparities?
Well, before we get into that, I want to just tag on to that last part. Too many people think and assume that COPD is a smoker's disease. It's true that about 70 to 75% of COPD patients were smokers, but that means there are millions and millions and millions that weren't smokers. And so, and that goes to earlier detection. What if they have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which, you know, we just call it alpha-1. It's a genetic predisposition to COPD. There's secondhand smoke. There's even thirdhand smoke. There are industrial causes. Mm-hmm. There are farmers that maybe are inhaling pesticides, insecticides, or particles from hay, or chicken farmers because the feathers have a lot of scurf and dandruff that gets into the air. We don't take that into consideration. So people, many people that have COPD would think, well, I don't smoke, so I don't have it, when indeed they do. And with alpha-1, anytime that anyone is diagnosed with alpha-1, since it's genetic, everybody in their family should also be tested to, I call it pulling a Barney Fife. If anyone ever watched the Andy Griffith Show, Barney Fife used to say, we've got to nip it in the bud, nip it in the bud.
Yep, you're so right. And just to tag on that a little bit more, even the environment, you know, when you've got pollution and fires out west with the dry conditions, those are also definitely ingredients for early stages of COPD. But back to my original question, is there any current research on COPD health disparities?
Well, I don't know if there's any research, but I've been very involved. In fact, I was asked to, I went and spoke at the NIH in Bethesda because there was a town hall specifically about health disparities with COPD between rural and metro urban areas. And I must tell you, the disparities are huge. And there, you can Google or look up. I know there's been some papers published, but I don't know if they're actually researching it. I mean, they quite possibly are. But the part of the disparity is access to health care. I live in a town of about 4,400 people. I need to, and remember, I used to live in the Phoenix, Arizona area. So I'm very familiar with access to pulmonary health care in a large metropolitan area, and now I live in a small rural town, I have to drive an hour to seek pulmonary care unless it's something that my family physician, you know, can help me with here. And I'm lucky because he's very good. We have a good relationship where I say we're partners in care.
Sure. Okay. Well, looking to the future now just a little bit, is there any research or clinical trials that you're aware of that are looking for new testing techniques for diagnosis or new treatments?
Since I'm not a physician, I probably don't remember all of the terms, and if I did, even what they possibly meant. But I think you're referring to things like biomarkers and how we can best tell if someone has COPD, or even better yet, if they're going to have an exacerbation. What I do know is there's a lot of research being done by young startups to develop wearables, sensors that can perhaps predict and know that you're about to have an exacerbation even before you do. And that's truly pulling a Barney Fife, nipping it in the bud, because that's going to prevent hospitalizations. So a lot of research is being done with wearables, and I think that's very important. And just home equipment. I love gadgets, and I'm always being asked to test this or test that. And as I look across my desk, I'm looking, honestly, without exaggerating, 8 different pulse oximeters, and 1, 2, 3, I think there's a 4th somewhere, home Bluetooth-based spirometers. And if people could use those, it could possibly help keep them out of the hospital, because they would know with their personal action plan, you know, I better call my doctor. No wonder I haven't been feeling quite so hot. Look at my numbers, how they've gone down. And since these devices at home are connected to their smartphone, they can easily be downloaded to their health clinic, to their care team. And I really think that we're missing the boat on that. They're being developed, but my gosh, if we could get physicians to use those and have their patients use them, I just think that's, how do I say this without, because I'm not making fun of COVID. COVID was terrible. But if you take the attitude, there's a silver lining to everything. The silver lining that came out of COVID was the rapid development of home devices that are connected, and to telehealth. Telehealth is just, it's the best thing since sliced bread, and it also keeps costs down. So I could go on and on about telehealth, because I really think that that's going to be the future. And since we're talking about our overarching theme is clinical trials and research, using these devices lowers the patient burden in participating in a trial. With all of this technology, we don't have to have the participant physically go to the clinic test site nearly as often. And I would propose and challenge CROs to even say, you know what, we need a blood draw. Let's send a phlebotomist to the patient's home instead of having them come in. Because as patients, as participants, we are helping ourselves by helping the whole, helping our fellow patients, but we're also doing a huge favor to the company that's running the trial. So why not go to them instead of them come to you? And that's where technology and understanding the concept of reducing the patient burden is so important. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, you know, it really does, John. It's funny as you were describing that, you know, when we went through COVID as a company, it really shut down a lot of our asthma and allergy customers, things like that. But the one thing it did spur on was development of our line of monitors and screeners and home use type devices that are Bluetooth enabled, as you said, and it really started to explore regions in ways that we had not before. And what we found was very much what you touched on, and that was that these devices really give us the opportunity to take multiple data points. You can see trends with much greater clarity, and most importantly, spot exacerbations far further upstream from the event than when by the time the patient becomes symptomatic. And it really does kind of speak to a healthcare system versus a disease care system, where we're trying to keep people in the green zone as much as possible. But if they do start to exacerbate, then we can catch it early on. We can, you know, take some less invasive means to try and control it before they end up in the emergency room.
Exactly. And the other thing too, and I hope you have lots of physicians that listen to these podcasts, because I just came back from 3 days of meetings in Atlanta, and one of the slides really surprised me. When a COPD patient is admitted to the hospital, 2/3 of the time, it's not because of their breathing and their low pulse oximetry or spirometry. It's for other underlying causes, perhaps something with the liver or their heart. That it could be a comorbidity, or it just could be something that's maybe not related. And that's why it's so important. It's so important to start treating patients holistically and look at the entire patient and not just the lungs. I had a minor heart attack about 4 years ago, and they took me to La Crosse, an hour away, because there's nothing here in this town that could treat that. And I kept asking my nurse, when are the pulmonary folks going to come in? Because I'm stage 4 COPD. And she finally snapped at me and said, you're not here for that. You're here because you had a heart attack. And I just looked at her and said, well, you know, the lungs and the heart are kind of connected. And that was the end of that. And I never saw pulmonary. I was very disappointed. At one point, I went to Mayo Clinic at the mothership in Rochester. And whenever I would go in, when he would see me, say, how are you today, John? And I'd start talking to him about how my breathing was. He said, no, we have time to get to that. How are you? He just wanted to, how's my life going? In other words, how am I as an individual? How am I as a person? He was treating me holistically and just wanted to know how I was. And I thought, my God, because, you know, Mayo has the reputation for treating the whole person. He should be a poster child. I really respect doctors that treat the entire person.
Now, that kind of goes into my next question. To reiterate, you said the organizations for COPDs to contact and get involved in research or clinical trials are CROs and clinicaltrials.gov, COPD Foundation, and it just, you know, you just mentioned, is to build a relationship with a pulmonologist like you have to get involved. Is there any other organizations that you would like to mention to our listeners that may not know how to get involved?
Yeah, there's a really good group. It's a nonprofit, and it was started by a man named Joe Morrison, and his father passed away of COPD. And Joe is he's a National Hot Rod Association top fuel driver. And he and I are good friends, and I'm on his board of directors. It's called Right to Breathe, and the two is the number two. So it's RIGHT numeral 2, BREATHE, no spaces. And there's a website. The website isn't incredibly active, but we do have webinars for patients that are educational and a chance for camaraderie, and patients can talk to patients. The second, third, and fourth Tuesday of each month at 3:30 Central, 4:30 Eastern. And it's a lot of fun. I help Joe co-host them, and we just have a lot of fun, and we have guest speakers, or sometimes we'll play Jeopardy, and we just get the patients involved. And when you have the same people coming back time after time, you know you're doing something good for the patient.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. We'll definitely post that in the description on your podcast when we post her. John, hey, thanks. You've been a great guest today. I've learned a lot. I know Troy has too. It's a different perspective from a COPD patient and how they manage their situation. And your attitude's just fantastic. I want to thank you again for being on.
I'd like to close with my trademark phrase, if it's without us, it's not about us. And that's why physicians, researchers, pharma, industry need to use the patient voice.
I agree. Thank you, John.
You reached the end of another episode of the Exhale Podcast. Don't forget to follow us for upcoming new episodes, and please take our survey to help provide good content for the future. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again on the Exhale Podcast, brought to you by Vitalograph.